This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Johnny Mercer wrote the lyrics to many great songs. Here's a short list. Any Place I Hang My Hat Is Home, Blues in the Night, Come Rain or Come Shine, Days of Wine and Roses, Fools Rush In, Hooray for Hollywood, I Remember You, I Want to Be Around, Jeepers Creepers, The Man That Got Away, Moon River, One for My Baby, Something's Gotta Give, That Old Black Magic, and You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby. Mercer's period of greatest popularity was between the mid-1930s and mid-50s. There were 221 weeks within that period when Mercer had at least one song in the top 10. My guest Philip Furia has written a new biography of Mercer called Skylark. Furia is also the author of The Poets of Tin Pan Alley and books about Irving Berlin and Ira Gershwin. As part of his research for Skylark, Furia interviewed many of Mercer's surviving family, friends, and colleagues. Many of them shared stories about Mercer's appalling behavior when he was drunk, yet, Furia says, the love everyone had for him seemed to override their worst memories. Mercer was born in Savannah, Georgia in 1909 and died in 1976. Let's start with the Mercer lyric that the new biography is named after. The music was written by Hoagie Carmichael, who sings on this 1956 recording.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring, where my heart can go a-journeying over the shadows and the rain to a blossom-covered lane, and in your lonely flight, haven't you heard the music of the night? Wonderful music, faint as the will-o'-the-wisp, crazy as a loon, sad as a gypsy serenading the moon. Skylark, I don't know if you can find these things, but my heart is riding on your wings. So if you see them anywhere, won't you lead me there?
Philip Furia, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you so much.
You said that Johnny Mercer is different from the other members of the pantheon of American popular song who were his contemporaries, different because of his background. How does his background compare to, you know, the Gershwins and Harold Arlen and Cole Porter, Irving Berlin?
Yeah, that's what interested me initially about him, because Mercer was the only Southerner in that whole group of largely New York Jewish immigrants or descended from immigrants, songwriters. The Gershwins, Berlin, even Cole Porter, who came from Indiana, can sound more New Yorkish, more urbane than anyone else. And here's Johnny Mercer from Savannah, an Episcopalian choir boy, mingling with all of these sophisticated, hard-nosed New York Jewish songwriters. And I thought, what a world for him to move in. There was a side of him that came out as I began to do research. He was very patrician. And I think he was put off a little bit by kind of, you know, the bluntness, the brusqueness of a lot of the other songwriters. He didn't have that energy and drive.
Let's get to Johnny Mercer's first lyric that actually had a life outside of his house. And that lyric is Out of Breath. And this is a song that he actually got into the Garrick Gaieties, which was a review, a musical review. How did he write the song?
Well, Johnny Mercer was a lyricist who, like most lyricists, wrote lyrics after music was completed. And he had a collaborator who had given him a melody, And he worked and worked and worked on it. And actually, his ambition was to be an actor. He really went to New York from Savannah wanting to make it as an actor. And it was a bug that never let go of him. And he went to the Garrick Gaieties and tried to get a role. And they said, nope, we don't need any more actors. All we need are pretty girls and songs. So he went back to this melody that his collaborator had given him and worked and worked and wrote many, many verses to it and took it over to the show. And they loved it. And it actually was featured very prominently in Garrick Gaieties.
Had he not thought about writing lyrics before this?
No, he had been doing that ever since he was about 15. He had been writing lyrics in his usual style because he loved what were then called race records, blues that were largely marketed to black audiences. And he loved Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and Louis Armstrong. And he wrote a lot of very, very vernacular bluesy kinds of lyrics. But this was his first, Out of Breath was his first review for first song for a Broadway review. And it has a kind of New York sophistication to it. He could be that urbane New Yorker when he wanted to be.
Well, let's hear Johnny Mercer singing Out of Breath. And this was recorded in 1971 when he appeared at the Lyrics and Lyricists series at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Here's Johnny Mercer.
Mine's a hopeless case, but there's one saving grace. Anyone would feel as I do. Out of breath and scared to death of you. Love was first divine, then explored and defined. Still the old sensation is new. Out of breath and scared to death of you. It takes all the strength that I can call to my command to hold your hand. I would speak at length about the love that should be made, but I'm afraid. Hercules and such never bothered me much. All you have to do is say boo. I'm out of breath and scared to death of you.
That's Johnny Mercer singing the first song, the first lyric that he wrote that actually got performed in a show. And that was recorded in 1971. My guest is Philip Furia, who has written a new biography of Johnny Mercer. It's called Skylark. Well, Garrick Gaieties not only gave a life to Mercer's song Out of Breath, Mercer met his wife, Ginger, at the Garrick Gaieties, too. She was a dancer in the show.
Yeah, she was in the chorus line, and he courted her. She was very, very different. She had grown up in Brooklyn. She was Jewish and very much a city girl, but she was very taken with this odd southern boy whose language she could barely understand, who used to walk around in a Panama hat and a white suit. But they married shortly thereafter. Not a happy marriage, as it turned out. But they were initially very much in love, and it came out of that first show.
Well, Johnny Mercer's song Out of Breath was performed in 1930 in Garrick Gaieties. What were the typical ways of breaking into music for a young songwriter at that time?
Well, for a young songwriter in New York, the way you broke in was through Tin Pan Alley, which was where all the sheet music publishers had their offices and where so many songs were kind of mass-produced, almost assembly line produced. And Johnny Mercer walked the pavements. He went to various music publishers trying to get them to accept his songs. And, you know, he would see the greats, Jerome Kern, Oscar Hammerstein, walking around and, you know, he just envied the kind of success they had. But it really took a long time before, even though he could place a song here and there in a Broadway review, it took him 3 or 4 years before he really had a hit song. And it was a lot of frustration. He talked about, he and his wife lived in Brooklyn, and he had 25 cents a day to take the subway in and buy himself two hot dogs and an orange soda for lunch and just kept knocking on those doors trying to sell his songs.
What was that first hit?
First hit was a song he wrote with Hoagy Carmichael in 1933 called Lazy Bones. And they sold the song to a publisher, and they got a recording of it. And both of them at that time were so poor that the banks wouldn't cash their first royalty checks was for like $1,000 because these guys looked so seedy. So one of the singers who had recorded the song took it to her bank and got it cashed. But it was their first big break. It was Mercer's first big break. Carmichael had had a couple of successful songs before that.
And after working with Hoagy Carmichael, Mercer went on to be the songwriter for the Paul Whiteman Band. Hoagy Carmichael and Paul Whiteman had already worked together. Was it typical for big bands then to have a songwriter on staff?
No, it was not typical. But Mercer was also a wonderful singer. And he actually broke into Paul Whiteman's band by winning a national singing contest. He was the New York champion. And then he won the national contest. And Whiteman kept him on as a singer, actually, to replace Bing Crosby. Crosby went to Hollywood, and Whiteman needed someone who could sing very rhythmical, jazzy tunes. And that was Mercer's talent. He had grown up listening to black records and, you know, black church music as a kid. So he had a wonderful sense of rhythm and jazz. And he sang with Whiteman for several years.
My guest is Philip Furia, the author of Skylark, The Life and Times of Johnny Mercer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Philip Furia, is the author of a new biography of lyricist Johnny Mercer. It's called Skylark. Johnny Mercer wrote for Hollywood in two different parts of his life. How did he get started writing for Hollywood? And Hollywood was another great way for a songwriter to become known and for his songs to become known.
Hollywood got interested in him when they heard him on the radio singing with Paul Whiteman. And Mercer's singing voice on the radio came across as if he were black. In fact, Whiteman had teamed him with his trombonist, a great jazz trombonist, Jack Teagarden. And they were a kind of Amos and Andy act. And everyone who listened thought these were two blacks who were, you know, talking dialogue back and forth and then breaking into song. And RKO Studios had a producer who really loved that sound and invited Mercer out to Hollywood to be an actor, a singer, and a songwriter. It was kind of like a triple threat. And Mercer still had that acting bug in him. He wanted to make it. He wanted to be a movie star like Bing Crosby. He was just astonished at the success Crosby had when he went out to Hollywood. And Mercer thought, this is going to happen to me. And so he left a great job with Paul Whiteman's band, went out to Hollywood, actually made two movies, and as an actor was a disaster. And wrote a few songs while he was out there, wrote a song with Fred Astaire called I'm Building Up to an Awful Letdown. But basically, his first venture into Hollywood was a bust. And they didn't renew his contract at RKO, and he was left high and dry.
And then a song that he wrote after leaving Hollywood ended up becoming his ticket back into Hollywood. And that song was I'm an Old Cowhand. Tell the story of the song and how it changed his life.
Well, after RKO canceled his contract, he realized how tough it was to make it in Hollywood. And as he did so often in his life, he wanted to get back home to Savannah, get back to his roots. And so he and his wife, and this is in, you know, 1936, got in a car and drove from Hollywood to Savannah. They'd never done that before, and they never did it again. It took him 3 days to drive across Texas. And as he was driving across Texas, he was astounded at seeing these cowboys in big hats and with spurs on, and they were driving cars and trucks. And I think, you know, after his bad experience in Hollywood, he kind of saw how ridiculous the image Hollywood portrayed of the Western cowboy was. And here was, in fact, in Texas, life imitating art. So the song came to him as they were driving. I'm an old cowhand from the Rio Grande, and I ride the range in my Ford V8. So it was a kind of, you know, send-up of the Hollywood that he'd come to really despise. And also, you know, just a very amusing look at the way these Texas cowboys were trying to look like the ones in the movies.
Mercer went to Hollywood hoping to have the kind of success he saw Bing Crosby have. And Bing Crosby was the one who actually recorded I'm an Old Cowhand, turned it into a hit and a well-known song. How did Bing Crosby end up recording it?
Well, Crosby and Mercer were friends, actually, through their wives. Johnny's wife, Ginger, had been a chorus girl, and she had made friends with another chorus girl, Dixie Lee, who went on to marry Bing Crosby, and Dolores Hope, who married Bob Hope. So the three women were lifelong friends. And as often happens, when the women are friends, the wives are friends, the husbands become friends too. So that Crosby kind of looked out for Johnny Mercer and helped him along, particularly during those kind of bleak early years in Hollywood in the 1930s. He recorded songs with him, or he would sing songs either on recordings or in movies that Johnny Mercer had written. So in some ways, he was kind of a mentor for Johnny Mercer.
So Bing Crosby sang the song in the movie Rhythm on the Range, and here's Bing Crosby's 1936 recording of I'm an Old Cow Hand with a lyric by Johnny Mercer.
I'm an old cow hand from the Rio Grande, but my legs ain't bowed and my cheeks ain't tan. I'm a cowboy who never saw a cow, never roped to steer, cause I don't know how. Sure ain't a fixin' to start in now. Oh, yippee-i-yo-ki-yay, yippee-i-yo-ki-yay. I'm an old cow hand and I come down from the Rio Grande. And I learned to ride, 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 for I learned to stand. I'm a riding fool who is up to date. I know every trail in the Lone Star State, cause I ride the range in the Ford V8. Oh, yippee-i-yo-ki-yay.
That's I'm an Old Cow Hand, recorded in 1936 by Bing Crosby. My guest, Philip Furia, is the author of a biography of Johnny Mercer, who wrote that song. This is one of the few songs where Johnny Mercer wrote music and lyrics?
He wrote several where he actually did music too, even though he could not read music and couldn't play a musical instrument. But it was very much like Irving Berlin. He would hear not only a melody, but harmonies in his head. And then he would go to a piano player and sing the song. And then the piano player would pick it out. And then Mercer would work with him playing the chords. It was really extraordinary. I interviewed his former son-in-law, who was a pianist, who had written some songs with him like that. And he said it took forever, but he knew exactly the chords he wanted. He could hear them in his head.
Now, when he was in Hollywood, Johnny Mercer fell in love with Judy Garland. They had an affair. How long did that affair last?
It started in 1941, and it was an on-and-off-again affair that lasted really until Judy Garland died. It was the most extraordinary thing I learned about him in researching the book, that Judy Garland really was the great, great love of his life. And although Garland biographers don't make a lot of the affair, I think really it was a very important affair for her. She was about to get married to her first husband, and she really wanted an older man, and she was very interested in men with literary and artistic qualities to them. And I think she fell deeply in love with Johnny Mercer. But he was married and had just adopted a little girl, Amanda, and he wrote a song about her called Mandy Is Two. And he was just nuts about his daughter. And he had this Southern genteel principle that he did not believe in divorce. And Judy Garland had just finally gotten some success in The Wizard of Oz, and realized, I think, that if word had gotten out that she was having an affair with an older married man, that her career, after waiting so long to take off, would have been in jeopardy. And she actually broke it off. And Mercer never got over it. And they renewed it several times until her death. And at another point in the 1960s, he actually asked Ginger for a divorce so that he could finally marry Judy Garland, and his kids were grown by then, and he was ready to walk out of the marriage. But again, it didn't take off. His wife became deathly ill. Doctors told him that she was going to die very soon, and he went in to see her in the hospital, and she said, "Please don't divorce me now." And he said, I'll stay with you as long as you live." And she recovered and lived for another 30 years.
Huh.
And in the meantime, Garland kept going downhill and downhill and downhill, and you know, finally died, I think, in 1969.
Philip Furia's new biography of Johnny Mercer is called Skylark. We'll talk more about Mercer and hear more of his songs in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philip Furia, the author of a new biography of lyricist Johnny Mercer called Skylark. Mercer's songs include Skylark, Moon River, The Days of Wine and Roses, Come Rain or Come Shine, Any Place I Hang My Hat Is Home, I Thought About You, The Man That Got Away, and Hooray for Hollywood. When we left off, Furia was talking about Johnny Mercer's secret affair with Judy Garland. He told me that even many Hollywood insiders didn't know about the affair.
It was not well known. In fact, in one Garland biography, there was an interview with Mickey Rooney, who said in 1941, Judy Garland had finally found the man she loved, and Rooney didn't know who it was. So it was kept pretty secret. It was just a few people in the family who knew about it, but they said Johnny was just gaga over her. You couldn't even talk to him. He'd just be staring straight forward, and you know, you'd have to kind of snap your fingers in front of his face. But the fact that it happened in 1941 and was so heartrending for him, it was one of those great lucky breaks that he was at that time starting to collaborate with Harold Arlen. And suddenly, in Mercer's lyrics, you know, before that he had written Jeepers Creepers and I'm an Old Cow Hand and You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby, but suddenly there comes this wrenching, agonizing pain into his lyrics, and he writes Blues in the Night, One for My Baby. You know, there's a whole new depth of emotion, and I'm sure it comes out of the affair with Garland. Also, a new kind of sensuality in things like That Old Black Magic, which is a song he wrote for her. So, you know, in a way, Judy Garland, although the love affair didn't work out, she kind of became his muse. And in a way, Judy Garland did that to Johnny Mercer.
Why don't we hear one of the songs that Mercer wrote with Arlen in this period? Why don't we listen to One for My Baby? And although this is such a deeply felt song and such a kind of heartbreaking song, it was written for the movie The Sky's the Limit and originally sung by Fred Astaire, who gives it a much jauntier rendition than what we're used to hearing from Sinatra.
Yeah, Sinatra's rendition, I think, is the classic one, and he captures all the pain. He once said a Johnny Mercer lyric is all the wit you wish you had and all the love you ever lost. And boy, he hit it with One for My Baby.
Oh, here's Frank Sinatra.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story you ought to know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road. I got the routine, put another nickel in the machine. Feeling so bad, can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you gotta be true to your code. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road. You'd never know it, but buddy, I'm a kind of poet, and I got a lot of things I'd like to say. And when I'm gloomy, won't you listen to me till it's talked away? Well, that's how it goes. And Joe, I know you're getting anxious to close. And thanks for the cheer. I hope you didn't mind my bending your ear. But this torch that I found's gotta be drowned, or it soon might explode. So make it one for my baby, and one more for the road. The long, that long, it's long.
That's Frank Sinatra singing One for My Baby, music by Harold Arlen, a lyric by Johnny Mercer. And Johnny Mercer is the subject of a new biography called Skylark, written by my guest, Philip Furia. So you think that that song was inspired in part by Johnny Mercer's affair with Judy Garland, which was broken off by the time the song was written. Did they ever work together?
Well, yeah, he wrote... One of his biggest hits, he wrote for Judy Garland in the movie The Harvey Girls on the Atchison, Topeka,
oh,
and Santa
course.
Fe.
Oh, of course. That's right.
Right. And he wrote a song for her when she had her television show. He never appeared on it, but she once had her two of her children, all three children, Liza and Joey and Lorna Luft were on. They were just little kids at the time. And for Liza Minnelli, she sang Liza. For Joey, she sang Happiness is a Thing Called Joe. But then she said, there's never been a song written about Lorna, but she said, my friend Johnny Mercer wrote one just for my daughter for me to do on this show. So they were in touch in that period, and Mercer just wrote a song for her daughter. It's a very touching moment in the show when she brings the Lorna up and then talks about Johnny Mercer and then sings this song.
We'll talk more about Johnny Mercer with his biographer, Philip Furia, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Philip Furia, is the author of a new biography of lyricist Johnny Mercer. It's called Skylark. So Johnny Mercer finally did have his success in Hollywood. But then what he really wanted was a hit Broadway show.
Oh, it just killed him that other Hollywood songwriters that he was senior to, like Frank Lesser and Alan J. Lerner, they went out to Broadway, and they had these smash hits like Guys and Dolls and My Fair Lady. And Mercer could see that those shows would be immortal. They would be revived over and over again. He always wanted that, and he never got it. He had successful shows like Little Abner, but no one's ever revived it. And it was just as one friend said, one of the big holes in his heart was his inability to write a great Broadway musical.
Now, with Harold Arlen, he did write the songs for the show St. Louis Woman.
Right.
And that had a song that became a really big hit for him, Come Rain or Come Shine. It had I Had Myself a True Love, which is another well-known song, and Riding on the Moon, a great song that isn't as well-known, but you know, some people still do it. How successful was the show?
The show was a flop. It was supposed to have starred Lena Horne, and that's why Mercer agreed to do it, because he had doubts about the book, the script for the show. It was written by two black writers, Arna Bontemps and County Cullen. And it's just a real clunker of a story. And Lena Horne was approached by the NAACP, and they pressured her not to do it because even though the show was written by blacks, it had some pretty awful racial stereotypes and a lot of kind of phony black dialect. And Lena Horne pulled out of the show. And for Mercer, that was the end, even though they had a wonderful new actress named Pearl Bailey, who had the secondary role. But without a big name star like Lena Horne and with that clunker of a book, that great, great score, the Arlen Merson score, was pretty much lost except for the big hit, Come Rain or Come Shine, which they recorded when the show opened. I think Margaret Whiting did a recording of that. And that was the only thing he could salvage.
Well, why don't we play a version of Come Rain or Come Shine? Why don't we hear the Ray Charles version of it?
Okay.
I'm gonna love you like no one's loved you. Come rain or come shine. High as a mountain, deep as a river. Come rain or come shine. I guess when you met me, it was just one of those things. But don't ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true. Well, if you let me, you're gonna love me like no one's loved me. Come rain or come shine. Happy together, unhappy together, and wouldn't it be fine? We're in Orion of the money, yeah, but I'm with you always. I'm with you rain or shine.
That's Ray Charles singing Come Rain or Come Shine, which was written by Harold Arlen and lyricist Johnny Mercer for the show St. Louis Woman, and my guest Philip Furia is the author of a biography of Johnny Mercer. How did Johnny Mercer react to the musical changes of the 1950s when rock and roll was the music for young people and it was crowding out American popular song from the charts? It was competing with it.
Well, Johnny Mercer, like so many of the other great, great songwriters of his era, really resented the coming of rock and roll, where, you know, performers were writing their own songs and, you know, there was just a complete fall off in the quality of songs. Songs were being aimed at the teenage market. And, you know, Ira Gershwin, Irving Berlin, those people could complain about it, but they'd had their careers. The sad thing about Mercer is that he was in his 40s, at the top of his form, and American popular music was moving away from him. And it was agonizing for him. And Hollywood musicals were starting to collapse because of the influx of television. They were shutting down movie production, and musicals were the most expensive kind of movies to make. There was less and less work for him writing scores for movies. So it was really a bitter, bitter time for him, the 1950s.
So here he was. Here was Mercer feeling very embattled because of the growing popularity of rock and roll, and movies again saved him.
Yeah, they weren't making many original movie musicals anymore. They were pretty much just doing movie versions of shows that had been hits on Broadway. But they still had what were called theme songs. A dramatic movie, not a musical, might have a song attached to it. And that's what finally saved Mercer in the 1960s. He teamed with Henry Mancini. And there was a movie, Breakfast at Tiffany's. And Johnny Mercer had to go ask Mancini. I mean, this was his far down as he was on his luck. He asked this young composer if he could please, please work with him and try to write a song to Mancini's melody for Breakfast at Tiffany's. And Mancini was thrilled to collaborate with Johnny Mercer. And Mercer, as often he did with collaborators, he would get the music in his head, and then he wanted to be by himself. He didn't like to be in the same room with a collaborator. And he would come back with sometimes two or three lyrics, different lyrics, and say to the composer, which one do you like? And the one he actually wrote for Breakfast at Tiffany's, the first one he wrote was called I'm Holly. You know, I'm Holly, like I want to be, like Holly on a tree back home. And Mancini said, well, okay, that fits the main character of the movie, Holly Golightly, but what else do you have? And he said, well, I've got this one that could either be called Red River, Blue River, or Moon River. And Mancini listened to it and just heard those first three notes, Moon River, and just knew at the time he was going to win the Academy Award. Just that wonderful opening. And suddenly Mercer was back. He won the Academy Award. Andy Williams made a hit record of it. And then the next year, he and Mancini won it again with Days of Wine and Roses. And it was a thrill. I mean, it's just one song a year. But he was on talk shows, and people knew his name again. So it was a kind of wonderful comeback for him in the 1960s.
Getting back to Moon River for a second, you know, one of the phrases in that that always mystified me was my huckleberry friend. And you say that Margaret Whiting, who was a good friend of his, suggested that he take that phrase out because it made no sense to her.
It made no sense to her, and he really respected her opinion. She was the daughter of one of his first great collaborators, Richard Whiting. So he always felt like a father to her. And he thought about it for a day, and he said, no, I'm going to keep it in. But, you know, it's a song that written at one of the worst points in his life, but it took him back to that place that I think he was always trying to get to, the place where he grew up, on Moon River, outside of Savannah. And it's so filled with the images of the river, you know, the marshland. And one of the things they did in the summers, they would go huckleberrying. They would go out and get huckleberries and then make ice cream out of it. And it's just a kind of childhood memory that came to him, at this bleak point in his career that went into the lyric. But when you hear it, you realize it's a huckleberry friend, but for me, it conjures up Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer on the Mississippi, that whole sense of boyhood ambition and, you know, the wonder of childhood and yet going out to see the world. And it's become, as Irving Berlin predicted, it's become a kind of folk song.
My guest is Philip Furrier, the author of Skylark, The Life and Times of Johnny Mercer. My guest, Philip Furrier, is the author of a new biography of lyricist Johnny Mercer. It's called Skylark. Now, Johnny Mercer had a kind of business life as well, in the sense that he was one of the co-founders of Capitol Records. How did he end up co-founding that?
Well, he met a businessman who ran a record store in Los Angeles named Glenn Wallach's. And they were just talking, and they realized that all the big record companies at the time, this was in the 1940s, were all based in New York, RCA, Victor, Columbia, and Decca. And they said, you know, well, Hollywood has brought so many talented singers to the West Coast. Why shouldn't there be a record company here on the West Coast? And so they agreed to start this, what they wanted, Mercer just wanted it to be a little company that put out a few songs. And Wallach's was a great businessman, and he really turned the business side of it into an enormous enterprise. And Mercer functioned, he wasn't much of a businessman, but he was a great, what they call an AR man, artists and repertoire. Mercer was the president of Capitol Records, and he was the one who decided which performers would sing what songs. And he was just brilliant at that. And he discovered all sorts of wonderful singers like Joe Stafford, Margaret Whiting, Peggy Lee, and it was Johnny Mercer who went to Nat King Cole, who at that time had a jazz trio, and persuaded Nat King Cole to sing as well as play the piano. And Cole didn't want to do it, but Mercer kept pressuring and pressuring and finally got Nat King Cole to do some recordings for Capitol. And Nat King Cole went on to become really the biggest singer in America until Frank Sinatra's career reblossomed in the 50s. And this was all Johnny Mercer's ear for talent and his ear for really good songs that made Capitol an artistic success as well as a business success.
Well, he did a lot of good on that end, didn't he?
it paid off, too. He gradually, because he was such a terrible businessman, he'd come in at 11 o'clock in the morning, look at a couple of letters, and then he'd just want to go record songs with somebody and then go out for a drink. And he kind of got shoved to the wings at Capitol Records in the 1950s when it really became an enormous business success. But it was bought out in 1955 by a European company, EMI. And Mercer sold his interest in it, and I think it came to almost $2 million. He became a millionaire by selling Capitol Records.
What was it like to research this book and to talk to people who are alive now and knew or worked with Joni Mercer?
It was surprisingly difficult for me because I had known a little bit about how he behaved when he drank. But so many people, and these people who absolutely adored him, told me these horrible, horrible stories about him, that at cocktail parties he would curse at his wife and sometimes would take his drink and pour it over her head at a party, that he would make sexual overtures to daughters of his collaborators, even to one of his own nieces, who told me this. And she was just revolted. And she thought I'd always been like a daughter to him. I was the same age as his daughter. And he got drunk and made it past me. And I found that very difficult to write about. And the sad thing is that he would attack everybody around him. And then, unlike some drunks who forget the next morning, he would always remember, and that Southern proper upbringing would come back, and he would feel terrible remorse and would inevitably send a dozen roses to whomever he'd offended the next morning with this abject note of apology. So, yeah, it was in some ways a horrible life, that he would be so abominable when he drank and then feel so guilty the next morning. And it was just like, there was a while there I couldn't write about him. I found him so repulsive, a person when he drank. I'd written about Irving Berlin, who could be crusty, and Ira Gershwin, who was just a sweetheart. But now, Joni Mercer, there was a darkness to him and an ugliness to him that I didn't want to write about him.
So you're in that position that we are with a lot of artists, unfortunately, which is learning how to keep loving the art while feeling uncomfortable about the artist.
Yeah, I'd never been in that position before. But finally, after interviewing more people, and the interviews would get very, very emotional sometimes as people talked about how much they loved him, but then would recount these grisly stories about him. And finally, I began to see how tormented he was. Mm-hmm. And it was a torment that went all the way back to his childhood and the kinds of tremendous expectations that his family made on him to make everything right, to always be the kindest, most generous person, to fix everything that went wrong in the family. And I just felt that this enormous pressure that when he drank, he could be bad. He could get out from under that. And I began to feel a kind of sympathy for him that just built and built, and then I could write.
Well, Philip Furia, thank you so much for talking with us about Joni Mercer.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Philip Furia's new biography of Joni Mercer is called Skylark.